of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
My daddy won. Oh, there was several comments made. You know, I was taking a job away from some man in the family, and I was thinking, why is my family worth less than yours?
There's been no movie made yet about, you know, rank and file rebels or Ron Carey's years in the Teamsters. That's not as glamorous as, you know, the murderous reign of Jimmy Hoffa.
She wrote about the 1919 steel strike and the lumber workers' strike in the Pacific Northwest. She wrote about the struggles of auto workers and textile workers and child labor.
Chicago-based folklorist Bucky Halter interviewed Sharon Sisson and her husband Richard about their experiences as iron workers in the Chicago area for the America Works podcast from the Library of Congress. Joe Allen is a former Teamster activist and author of The Package King, a rank-and-file history of UPS. Joe worked for nearly a decade at UPS at the old Watertown Hub outside of Boston and the Jefferson Street Hub in Chicago. He's also the author of Vietnam, The Last War the U.S. Lost, and People Wasn't Meant to Burn, a true story of housing, race, and murder in Chicago. Labor History Today's Alan Weirdeck talked with Joe recently about the history and inner workings at the Teamsters, working conditions at UPS, past and present, and more. And on this week's Labor History in 2, Rick Smith tells us about Mary Heaton Vorse. She witnessed the Massachusetts textile strike, an experience that was a turning point in her life. I'm Chris Scarlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. I hope you enjoy the show.
Unless we organize, which side are you on? Which side are you on?
From the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
Welcome to America Works. Excerpts from interviews with contemporary workers throughout the United States, collected by the library's American Folklife Center as part of its Occupational Folklife Project. This episode of America Works featured Chicago-based folklorist Bucky Halter interviewing ironworker Sharon Sisson and her husband Richard Sisson. Their interview, which was recorded at Ironworkers Local No. 63 headquarters in Broadville, Illinois, covers numerous topics, including Sharon's early experiences as a woman entering a previously male-dominated trade.
Now, how did you get into ironwork and sharing?
They had a sign at the unemployment office.
A sign at the unemployment office? What did it say?
They were looking for people to fill a test slot that they had. So I started as an apprentice through the school program.
Yeah.
And there was a good portion of guys that came through the apprentice program when I was a student there. And they served their apprentice with one company doing one thing.
Yeah.
I personally think that they should serve so many months with like different contractors to just see everything.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you have one guy that did curtain all his entire life, doesn't know anything about anything else.
Yeah. So your first job, what did you do?
I worked in skylights at O'Hare on a maintenance building. I worked at Block 57. I did a lot of work at the Navy Yard. Mm-hmm. Different other small jobs. I did a couple days doing some reinforcement steel on the Sears Tower. I worked one day at the Hancock Center. We did all the emergency stairs at the Board of Trade.
Yeah. Now, did you do any welding too? Some of the 63
lots
people?
Of welding.
Yeah.
At the Cook County Jail. We did a bunch of welding steel plates up, and I worked with a new guy in there, and he work on one side and I worked on the other. We just passed the welding slinger back and forth. And at the end of the job, the guy said, I never knew a woman that could weld.
Were there many women in the apprenticeship program or starting in the market?
No.
When you were?
I don't know whether that got easier. And some women I consider were more sheltered because they had a father in the business. So it's just my opinion, mind you, that the men respected that more because they knew their father. I had nobody.
Yeah. Now, what kind of reception did you get when you started?
I don't want to say it was real warm either. It depends. Yeah. And there was a large mix of people who didn't like it. There were young guys and there were old guys. Oh, there was several comments made. You know, I was taking a job away from some man in the family.
Oh,
and I was thinking, my son's father died when he was very young. And my thought is why is my family worth less than yours? Because I'm a woman and a mother. You know, because you're a man and a father, your family means more? I don't think so. My pink tools and my pink bucket and my pink bibs wasn't just because I'm a girl. I did it on purpose, knowing that it's going to bother them. And there was one job I worked on that I actually could not wear my pink bibs. And, you know, I made a comment that it's pretty bad that I have to adjust my clothing because you can't handle it. You know, it's like, excuse me, I'm not here to model for you, dude, you know. I can't say they're all bad and they're all nasty and they hate women. That's not true.
Yeah.
But there's prejudice everywhere for everything. It's not just women.
She could do the work that most any guy could do. And she could do more work than a lot of guys wanted to do. So she was always a good employee to have on a crew.
They knew what they were going to get. I came to work every day. For the most part, I did what I was told, did my little job, whatever it was that they gave me to do. I can deal with, I don't like you just because you're a girl. It's like, what's your problem, dude? My problem. And I didn't like that I wasn't always judged by what I could do. So it wasn't all bad, but most of the protection that I got was created by myself. If I didn't look out for me, nobody else was going to.
Yeah.
But they were all pretty slow. There was one guy there named Mario, and he was married, and he had kids. And the guy obviously had the hots for me. He was asking me to go out with him. He used to drip water on me from up above, little drops of water. I didn't like that. And I said, that's it. I'm going to put a freaking snake in his lunchbox. Once again, my buddy's like, oh, God, come on. I'm like, this guy, he needs to be taught a lesson. And we walked in the shanty one night, and I got a big glass of water out of water cooler, and I threw it on him. I said, now leave me the hell alone. And he wouldn't leave me alone. So I went to the pet store that night, and they didn't have a snake cheap enough, but they did have a spider, a ginormous tarantula like this. And they wanted $25 for it. And I told the lady, I said, I'll give you $15 cash and I'll bring it back tomorrow and give me $10 back. And she says, okay, you want to rent my spider? Like, yeah, I don't need it for a day. So she's like, okay, here. So I take this spider, everybody leaves the shanty and dump it in the guy's lunchbox. And we come in at coffee time and everybody's sitting around playing cards and this guy's over in the corner. Everybody knew except him. Everybody knew. So they're all kind of watching out the corner of their eye, and he flips up the top of his lunchbox and he reaches in without looking, and everyone's going, you could feel the sides of the trailer just suck in from everybody going, afraid he's going to bring his fire out, right? Brings out his sandwich. It's a sandwich, and after a while he gets his chips, and then he drags the lunchbox over and he has to look in it for something. There's a spider in there. He jumped up, kicked the lunchbox across the floor, it ends up with my feet, and I looked in there and there's a spider in there. And I reached in, they picked out the tarantula. I said, it's just a little old hairy spider. I swear to God, he peed his pants. Put it in a baggie, put some holes in it, and I took it back to the pet shop. Never messed with me again.
Yeah. You also had fun swearing like a truck driver.
Oh, shut up. Don't mess. Don't mess. Because I'm not going to put sugar on it first. There's no pudding before I give you the answer. No, you're just going to get it.
Yeah.
Many don't do that. Some aren't appreciative of their quality. There's no other way to be in our environment, okay? There's other places where you can beat around the bush and it's okay. And exactly, sometimes you have to do that, but not here.
She also has a very sly way of surprising crews. People will show up for work in the morning and there'll be 20 gifts on the table for everybody in the job. Where did this come from? Nobody knew. Nobody could figure it out quite who it was.
Valentine's Day, I went around to every guy on the job and I said, do you want pink, yellow, or red? And they're like, what? And they're thinking I'm going to hang some ladies' panties in their car or something, because that I went around too. And I wouldn't tell them what it was for. And some guys would not choose. They were terrified of what I was going to do.
Yeah.
And other guys, you know, they were into it. It's like, okay, I'll take this color. And all it was, my son and I spent the night before Valentine's Day. I went to the florist and I got long stem roses, pink, yellow, and red.
Yeah.
And everybody chose, whoever chose their color, got that color. And they got a little baggie of Hershey's Hugs and Kisses, those candies, tied up to the flower. And the next day, there they were. At the end of the day, there was one guy that got halfway home, turned around and came back because he forgot his rose. that's important to me. It meant that, that goofy stuff that I did was, in fact, appreciated.
She had a lot of fun. Trust me, she had a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Chicago Iron Workers Sharon Sisson and Richard Sisson. They were interviewed for the Library of Congress's Occupational Folklife Project by folklorist Bucky Hawker. To hear their complete interview, as well as interviews with other iron workers who were documented as part of the Archie Green Fellowship Project, Iron Workers in America's Upper Midwest, please visit us online at www.loc.gov/folklife. On behalf of the American Folklife Center, this is folklorist Nancy Gross. Thank you for listening to America Works.
From the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
Joe Allen is a former Teamster activist and author of The Package King, a rank-and-file history of UPS. Joe worked for nearly a decade at UPS at the old Watertown Hub outside of Boston and the Jefferson Street Hub in Chicago. He's also the author of Vietnam, the Last War the U.S. Lost, and People Wasn't Meant to Burn, a true story of housing, race, and murder in Chicago. Labor History Today's Alan Weirdak talked with Joe recently about the history and inner workings at the Teamsters, working conditions at UPS, past and present, and more. Here's Alan.
You worked at UPS for roughly a decade in Boston and Chicago. While you intentionally avoided including those stories, how did your work experience at UPS influence not just you writing the book, but also in your approach?
I think that your choice of topics or books or, you know, whatever you may be curious about obviously reflects something about your personal experience. And I spent most of my working life in something which we now call the logistics industry, which is still best known as, you know, trucking, freight, moving. I mean, we interchangeably use these terms and everybody seems to know what they're talking about, but we broadly call this the logistics industry now. But mine isn't a personal memoir. It is a political history, and it was informed by my previous reading on the American economy and trade unions and labor, and kind of talk about three things, which is the interrelationship between UPS, which was a tiny delivery company, a kind of boutique delivery service before World War II, that now morphs into what is could be argued to be the largest logistics company in the world. How that interacted with the institution of the Teamsters Union, because early on the Teamsters won bargaining rights sometime in the 1930s. It's hard to nail down a little bit, actually, because local union record keeping is terrible. But sometime in the 1930s, and the UPS and the Teamsters grew together from, say, the Second World War on. And the other factor in that is rank-and-file workers who were influenced by different political ideas and ideas of what a trade union is and their own experience in both in conflict with the company and with the union and in conflict with both at many times. And so those three things are what I try to kind of lay out in the history of UPS and the Teamsters and what that meant both for workers at UPS, but particularly what was the impact of that from the 1970s onward, where UPS emerges as not just this massive U.S. corporation, but a kind of trendsetter in labor relations, and what the consequences were that for the American working class as a whole, which you have to say are pretty negative.
What I found to be really interesting was that it's a political history, but it's a political history of the Teamsters as well as shedding a light on national politics. So when you're talking about how UPS and the Teamsters kind of grew in tandem, does that business and management in labor unions, what does that relationship and that growth do for the rank and file?
First of all, people obviously know, whether it's good or bad, right or wrong, is that their knowledge of the Teamsters is mostly from the movies, which unfortunately most of the time is absolutely true. There's been no movie made yet about, you know, rank-and-file rebels or Ron Carey's years in the Teamsters. That's not as glamorous as you know, the murderous reign of Jimmy Hoffa. I do think one of the benefits, it may be an unintended benefit of The Irishman, which was a very popular recent Netflix production, is that I hope it de-glamorizes Jimmy Hoffa Sr., because I think what it does is it sort of takes away a lot of the myths about him. Not completely. And there are things that Hoffa Sr. was very clever at, but spent the last few years of his life skulking around with his mobster buddies who, you know, who got tired of him bothering him about being put in charge of the union again, and they eventually get rid of him. So I hope that that de-glamorizes who Hoffa Sr. was. The Teamsters has been largely dominated by people who thought unions were a business. So you're not talking about people who were the UPS or other major employers at a hard time convincing of having very conservative contracts and approach to the health and welfare of their members. What really kind of changes in, I think, the economic impact and political impact of this for a lot of workers outside of UPS is from the 1970s onward. I mean, UPS becomes in 1976 a 48-state contiguous operation. There's also several other things that go on in the 1970s. One is with the end of the post-war boom, that the American business goes into two offensives. One is internationally against their rivals, and the other is domestically against their workers. So you see a bigger push by the bosses to lower wages, speed up, and make working conditions far worse than they had been before. This is when even many old-style, older generation of UPS workers, you know, they noticed that there was change. But sometimes they identify that change with Jim Casey, the founder and longtime CEO or chairman of the board of UPS, sort of, you know, playing on, coming to an end of that type of role in the company. So the old boss is gone and the new guys take over and they screw. There's an element of truth to that, but there's much larger forces at work. And the third is that in the 1970s, you also saw the first sort of national explosion of rank and file rebellion inside the Teamsters and inside UPS. It's the 1970s that are a turning point on all of these things. UPS becomes a massive company, you know, which employs over 100,000 people. It begins to dwarf all the other major freight companies in terms of what it represents in the Teamsters Union. And a couple of the consequences of that are that, unlike in, say, the 1960s, when Hoffa Sr., his kind of last big achievement was creating the National Master Freight Agreement, which organized the great bulk of the freight industry in the United States and represented hundreds of employers kind of smashed into this, you know, one agreement. I think there was something like 500,000 truck drivers and warehouse workers were covered by the Master Freight Agreement. And UPS is really kind of seen as a minor player in all that. So, you know, 20 years later, 30 years later, UPS becomes the largest Teamster employer with nearly, between it and UPS Freight, with somewhere between 280,000 workers, and the Teamsters themselves shrinks from peaking out at about 2.2 million in the mid-70s to declining pretty badly to about half that size when Ron Carey was elected Teamster president in 1991. So this period from the 70s through the early 90s is a kind of big role reversal. The Teamsters, which had been this incredibly powerful union, gets sapped of its strength. UPS, which had been a kind of marginal Teamster employer, becomes the most dominant Teamster employer. And here we are in 2020, and UPS is now the largest private sector employer in the country. So when you pull back the lens and look backward and come forward on all of these things, it's pretty important to understand the dynamics of all of that to understand where we got to right now.
Thinking more currently, but also going back in time with focusing on working conditions, I noticed in your book that UPS keeps making more money. Conditions essentially just seem to worsen.
Yes.
From the switch and focus to logistics and into today. So I was wondering if you could talk about how the company evolves, but working conditions essentially seem to worsen.
Well, I think ever since the rise of industrial capitalism, the workplace has always been a battle between workers and the bosses over working conditions. I mean, I think you have to say that because it's not like that's a new thing. I think what's important to recognize is that when workers were able to win through hard-fought campaigning better conditions through their contracts, but also through federal laws like OSHA that were created in the early 70s. It took until 1970 to pass a Workplace Safety Act in the United States. One of the bizarre twists on Upton's and Sinclair's book, The Jungle, which was meant to be about the working conditions of workers and highlight that, is that what the media glommed onto was really how badly the food was processed, which isn't an irrelevant issue, don't get me wrong. It's just that it was much more acceptable for the liberal, progressive-minded middle classes to campaign for something around food safety, but it took another 70 years for workers to get that type of consideration. And so ever since the 1970s, the employers have been carrying out a political campaign to weaken, if not to outrightly abolish OSHA. And so you have two things particularly going on with UPS, is that one is that working conditions have always been a battleground, both inside the hubs where people load, unload, sort packages, deal with all sorts of, chemicals and so forth that spill, break open, ventilation issues, and drivers who are out on the streets, running their asses off, dealing with heavy packages, trying to make these, really unbearable numbers every day in pretty horrendous conditions. So, well before the pandemic hit and those issues of the safety around the coronavirus, in the summer of 2018 and 19, the media highlighted both the death, injuries caused by excessive heat to particularly package car drivers in the summertime. And this wasn't just in the Southwest, it was all over the country. And so, UPS has gotten very rich off of a couple of things. One is they really introduced part-time work on a scale that had previously not existed before, at least within one company. So today, as has been true for many decades now, two-thirds of UPSers are part-timers who mostly work in the hubs. They have a 90% turnover rate, and that is the industry standard. So whether you go to FedEx or Amazon, I can't speak for the post office on that issue because I just don't know. The three big private employers are mostly part-time, horrendous turnover rate, terrible working conditions. And much of this derives from what UPS began, particularly in the 1970s. And they've made an enormous amount of money off this. It's not just the people who are part-time, but they earn a third or half the wage of full-time workers, which is still true to this day. And who are hyper-exploited inside the hub. So I think that when you look at this picture, UPS, which for most of its history didn't do any advertising, it kind of snuck up on its competitors. I have a chapter called The Quiet Giant, where by 1968, it's delivering half the number of packages as the post office. So it becomes like the other post office, but had this kind of image of being a benign employer and company owned by the workers, because management was largely owned the bulk of its stock. And it's almost until very recently, every head of the company had been a UPS worker at some point. Carol Tomei, who is now CEO, was taken from Home Depot. So that tells you something about the changes at UPS. But it had this kind of image that, and it had a lot of friends in the media who kind of promoted this image. And then in the late 1980s, it began doing television commercials for the first time, which are just kind of fun to look at and laugh at. We like to keep our trucks clean, sort of promoting this kind of image of the modern stellar corporation. But I think I wasn't the first person to say that behind this kind of 20th, now 21st century image are really kind of 19th century working conditions.
What would you say is the role of the federal government throughout the history of UPS and the Teamsters, not just in terms of the growth of UPS, but also for reducing and diminishing the power of OSHA? I think OSHA is really important because we think about today how OSHA is kind of still an empty shell, and the power of political lobbying in undermining OSHA that you talk about in your book.
Well, I'll say yes, but corporate America still hates OSHA. I mean, you have to remember that even having a shell of an operation is still having a shell of an operation. And if we start with most recent stuff, OSHA, for the most part, has been completely absent around dealing with issues related to the pandemic. So in some sense, that is a result not just of Trump, but you know, of a kind of campaign that really got going in the 1990s with the so-called Republican Revolution to kind of almost do away with it. I kind of go through a lot of that. And there's a whole chapter on that in the book because I see that as, you know, very important. I think you have to, when you pull back the lens, is that you go back to the turning point after World War II, where after the wartime contingencies, the question was, what role would the federal government play in economic development, shaping it, spending it? And of course, the thing that is the most prominent, because we're on them every day, is the federal highway system. And that was a boon for the entire freight industry. So railroads, even though trucking becomes motorized during World War I, and Eisenhower leads this very famous truck caravan across the country during the 1920s to kind of highlight how backward the American road system was, how inadequate it was. And a lot of this is couched in military terms. The fact is, it's not surprising that 30 years later, it's Eisenhower who presides over the National Defense Highway Act, which is the formal name of the federal highway system. But after the Second World War, the growth of the federal highway system along with state spending is what kind of shifts the shipment of goods regionally and locally away from the railroads to the trucking industry, to the freight industry. And of course, it's not an accident that not only does that take place, but, you know, the New Deal legislation, because trucking becomes federally regulated during the 1930s with the Motor, you know, Carrier Safety Act, is that it's all about the stability of the industry, because nobody wants to go back to this kind of chaotic, boom-bust way of operating businesses. And so you put all those together, is that you have this massive boom in federal spending on highways and a comparable state spending. This really greases the road, literally, for the massive expansion of the trucking industry. And one part of that is UPS, but that's still to be seen down the road. And the kind of tight regulation to promote stability in the industry itself creates this situation in which the Teamsters as an institution just grows massively. And the Teamsters themselves are just so much bigger than most trucking companies. Well, this whole thing really collapses in the 1970s to deregulate a whole parts of the U.S. economy. And when trucking and aviation and finance and a whole series of industries are deregulated in the early, late 70s, early 80s, much of what the basis for the Teamsters Union growth just disappears. And of course, that's usually identified with Ronald Reagan, but I think it's important to recognize that, you know, these were politically driven by, particularly by Ted Kennedy and Jimmy Carter, particularly in the trucking industry. But those who had a vested interest in keeping the system the way it was, because the way the trucking industry was organized for the benefit of a few, was a perfect example of just crony capitalism. You know, Ralph Nader, who regretted at first advocating deregulation, and he said it later, he said, it was the biggest mistake of my life. One of the original studies of his Nader Raider groups was to expose how corrupt the Interstate Commerce Commission was. And he, I mean, it's all right. I mean, it's absolutely true, right? For a lot of liberals, you know, the solution to that was deregulation. Of course, what deregulation really did was it led to a collapse of old companies and a massive attack on older secure workers and worsening working conditions for the rest. And of course, during that same time, you have the rise of UPS as the major Teamster employer. And what makes it an oddity in the logistics industry is that it's unionized. So if you compare that to FedEx, you know, which has its origins in the 1970s, or Amazon, which was founded in 1995, now a massive employer, is that they're almost exclusively non-union. I mean, they have little parts of them that are unionized, but they're defined by being non-union employers. So that's both what makes UPS sort of an oddity and has a unique history. And part of the reason why UPS has continued to be a major player in the trucking industry is because the Teamsters have been there to primarily, except during the years of Ron Kerry, to make sure that UPS remains competitive with the other employers, and the people who have not benefited from that are the rank and file, the Teamsters, or the non-union workers at other big logistics giants.
Neoliberalism in the 1970s is this like bipartisan, partly democratic gutting of regulations. Those that are mindful of, you know, labor history and political history, if that's something that they use to kind of be hypercritical of the Democratic Party, even today, because they can point to someone like Jimmy Carter and deregulation, or even Ralph Nader. So I was wondering if you've ever noticed anything like that.
If you look at the Hoffa years, I mean, Hoffa Sr., Hoffa supported people who were willing to support him. So we think of the battles with Robert Kennedy when Hoffa had to go before the Senate Rackets Committee. He very much played the wounded, angry worker against this snotty rich kid. What was forgotten in all that is that Kennedy was pretty much right on all about the corruption of Hoffa and the Teamsters, right? So I think that while they had their own interest for going after Teamster corruption, which was real, and the violence in the union, which was real, mostly directed at Teamster members, Hoffa was able to turn it into a public relations boon for himself. Now, I think when you go back and look at the big picture again on these things, is that ever since the rise of industrial capitalism, particularly with the creation of a single market across the United States, transport workers, whether it's railroad workers or waterfront workers or truck drivers or delivery workers now, is that those are potentially, and have at different points in time, shown themselves to be very powerful groups of workers who can help raise the political power and working conditions of the entire working class, which is why throughout American history, it's not an accident that those unions and their leaders, who have been very different individuals and very different politics throughout history, have been the subject of federal government political repression. So it's not an accident, for example, the most biggest, most modern uprising of industrial workers in the late 19th century was the 1877 railroad strikes, which are always portrayed as uprisings, which is really what they were in a lot of ways. I mean, where railroad workers and sympathizers took over whole towns and cities and had to be crushed by the federal army. Eugene Debs, of course, the most famous American socialist, began life as the leader of the American Railroad Union and was put in prison following the Pullman strike, which, you know, was defeated, but kind of was one of the major labor battles of the 1890s. It made him a socialist. When you move into the 20th century, Harry Bridges led the organizing of the West Coast Dockers. Harry, of course, had a lifelong sympathy, possible, but it's never been proved, membership in the Communist Party. But that was clearly the people that he looked to for their leadership. In the mid-1930s was the Minneapolis Trotskyists, who led the struggles of that really created the idea of what a modern trucking union would look like, who were later, Harry Bridges was subject to 20 years of political persecution. The Minneapolis Trotskyists, with the help of people like Jimmy Hoffa, were driven out of the union in the early 1940s. And then Hoffa himself becomes the focus of federal government's investigations and scrutiny, because it's really over-the-road freight drivers who become, along with auto workers, really the most powerful workers in the country. And so when you look at this history, you have to say that this is a continual feature of American politics in the labor movement.
Joe Allen, former Teamster activist and author of The Package King, a rank-and-file history of UPS. He talked with Labor History Today's Alan Weirdak.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1874. That was the day that Mary Heaton Vorse was born in New York City. Mary grew up in Amherst, Massachusetts, in a family with significant financial means. She traveled across Europe with her parents, where she received her education and learned to speak multiple languages fluently. She then worked as a book reviewer for the Criterion magazine. In 1912, Mary and the man who would be her husband witnessed what would be known as the Bread and Roses textile strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. The experience was a great turning point in her life. She later wrote, "Both Joe O'Brien and I had come a long road to get to Lawrence. Together, we experienced the realization of the human cost of our industrial life. Something transforming happened to both of us. We knew now where we belonged, on the side of the workers and not with the comfortable people among whom we were born. some synthesis had taken place between my life and that of the workers. Some peculiar change that would never again permit me to look with indifference on the fact that riches for the few were made by misery of the many. It was in Lawrence that we realized what we must do, that we could make one contribution, that of writing the workers' story as long as we lived. For more than 50 years after Lawrence, Mary traveled the United States reporting and participating in strikes and the labor movement. She wrote about the 1919 steel strike and the lumber workers' strike in the Pacific Northwest. She wrote about the struggles of auto workers and textile workers and child labor. In 1962, the United Auto Workers honored Mary with their Social Justice Award. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You're either with the Union or a thug for J.H. Blair.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app, and even better, you can like it in your podcast app and pass it along. You too can be part of Labor History Today. You can read a labor history item. Just shoot us a note, laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Our music today is a rock and reggae version of the labor classic, Which Side Are You On? It's off of George Mann's brand new CD, The Coronavirus Sessions, available directly from George. Email him at georgemann@att.net. That's George, M-A-N-N, at att.net. We've got a link in the podcast notes. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices, broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to more than 70 labor radio and podcast shows. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.